You are listening to Service Course by The Cycling Podcast with Lizzie Banks and Tom Whalley.
Lizzie, I know we've recorded the podcast today, but that EF Pro Cycling kit's just come out and I need your reaction to it. I think it's, well, I bet you can guess what I think. I think it's absolutely brilliant. I think it's rad. The bikes look great as well. I want to see more stuff like that. Over to you.
I mean, it's amazing. I love it. I saw it and I thought, wow, that's crazy. I love it. Before I even knew anything about this collaboration with Palace, and I don't know anything about Palace skateboarding. I don't know anything about skateboarding, but whatever, who cares? It's amazing. And the Ecuadorian national champs jersey is just, it's just something else. The best thing about it though, you need to see the POC lids, because they've got the duck on the back of the lid, and the way the lid shapes, it's like the beak and the duck, and oh, you've just got to look at it. It's the coolest thing ever. I'm a pretty big fan of like crazy out there wacky design that sometimes divides opinion, because I don't know, I just think if it's cool and loud and you wear it and you love it, then who cares what other people think? So nice one, EF.
There was another hot take on the EF Pro Cycling kit in our Service Course WhatsApp group. This one from the Buffalo himself, Richard Moore. He simply sent this clip of Ali G.
What the fuck is that, man?
Lizzie, I wasn't expecting to see you back at home so soon.
Well, life is a roller coaster, Tom, and we're recording this between Flesh and Liège, and I've made an unexpected journey back home. I was supposed to be racing both of the Ardennes Classics and Amstel Gold as well, which has just been cancelled. But in a funny series of twists and turns, which 2020 seems to like to throw at us, I'm back home after having had a few minor health issues, and I'm just back for a bit of rest. I actually had an asthma attack in the final stage of the Giro, and I kind of thought I was okay during the World's Week, and then got into the race and turned out I wasn't really okay. And after that, yeah, I knew that I just wasn't able to race these two races, really, unfortunately. I probably could have got round them, but I wouldn't have been much use to my team, and I would have only done myself more damage. So yeah, one of those things, it's best to come home, take some rest, reset, and then hopefully be ready to go for Flanders. And well, if Roubaix happens, Roubaix, but at the moment it's looking like that's going to be cancelled as well.
Yeah, it's a little bit dicey out there with certain races. You've not had a bad time though, Lizzie, really? I mean, during the Giro, I was glued to the TV, waiting for the TV coverage to start. but we'll talk about that. But hey, the Giro wasn't bad. I'm going to ask you a question here, actually. Last time we were on, I said, Lizzie, which stage have you earmarked and which stage are you going to win? You were really coy about it. The stage that you won, was that the stage that you'd earmarked?
I actually can't remember, to be honest. I mean, when you look at the stages, you see it's really easy to, well, sometimes it's easy to read a race. And in order for there to be a breakaway, it's got to be late enough in the race that the GC is kind of set a bit. It's got to not be a clear sprint day because there's usually only so many opportunities for a sprint. Yeah, usually the final day, maybe there's an opportunity for a breakaway, but do you want to leave going for a stage win to the final day? So this day, the day that I won, was definitely a breakaway day. And I'm not sure if I'd eyed it up that far in advance. To be honest, when we last spoke, Tom, I probably hadn't looked at the Giro route in very much detail. The day before, I definitely eyed it up, and we knew that it was a breakaway opportunity. And I knew that if I wanted to go for it, I had to go a long, long way out. It was kind of 100 kilometres to go where you needed to start trying. And I started trying about 95, 96 kilometres to go. And the moment that I went, I just said to my teammate, Marlon, this is a great time to go, I said in the radio. And then I was coming from behind and I kind of saw her move back into the bunch. And then I thought, well, sod it, I'll go myself. So came around the bunch with speed, attacked, 86 kilometres to go, went on my own. And I thought, oh, bloody hell, this is a long way to go on your own. And thankfully, Eugenia Bujak from Alais bridged over to me, and we had a long, long way to go. It was a 170-kilometre stage, 180 including neutral. But I said to her, you know, we've just got to keep pushing. The gap went out to 2 minutes, and she said, oh, you know, we can ease off now. And I was like, we need 6 or 7 minutes with 70k to go, was what I felt, because usually you need like a minute per 10k. And yeah, we kept pushing. Gap went out to 6.5 minutes, and yeah, we did it. We stayed away to the finish. I knew, our team had reconned the finish. I'd looked at it. I knew there was a steep section. I knew that that's where I'd have my advantage and I could attack her in the end. And I attacked her with just over a kilometre to go, and yeah, won the stage. And it was just really cool. It was so awesome. Last year when I won my first stage, it was quite overwhelming the first time you get a pro win, and you almost kind of don't know how to feel or how to react. But I was just elated this year. I was really just so happy about it.
È tempo di decretare la vincitrice della tappa odierna, signore e signori, vince Elizabeth Banks.
But I wasn't quite so happy when Annemiek nicked my podium champagne. And when I recorded the diary, I didn't actually know quite what was going on. But it transpired afterwards. So I crossed the line first, Eugenia was second. Annemiek then was the first of the bunch. She did a two-handed arm salute and raised her arms and thought she'd won. They thought they'd caught the breakaway. I'm not quite sure how, because, you know, there was a point where we had 6 minutes and it was pretty clear we were away. We then went onto the podium trailer, and it was all a bit of a shambles because it's DIY and you pick up your own thing and you go on. I wasn't even on the trailer when Annemiek and Eugenia were on there. Annemiek went on in her Worlds outfit. So she knows how the podium ceremony works. She's done it enough times. Went on in her Worlds outfit, sprayed the champagne for the winner, came back off. Then they brought Eugenia on for second. And this is all really weird, right? Because they usually bring 3, 2, 1 on at the same time. Brought Eugenia out for second, took her back. Then I came onto the trailer, went out for first, was a bit confused why the second and third place weren't there. And I was also confused why there was an empty bottle of Astoria in front of me. And I thought, you know, when I was going through some real depths of the pain cave, I was the bottle was the one thing that was pushing me. You know, last year when I won the stage, I'd always wanted one of those bottles, and obviously I want to win the stage, but also I just really want another one of those bottles. And I got there and I was like, what the hell is going on? Anyway, so I went behind, you know, waved to the crowd, went behind and said, where's my bottle? You know, I'll take this one. And the organizer said, no, that's not for you. And Annemiek's like, oh, no, it's fine, take it. And I said, oh, you know, jokingly, oh, Annemiek, you've had enough of these, you know, because she goes on the podium every day. Again, not knowing what had happened. So I kind of thought, oh, I'm really sorry if she doesn't have one for the pink jersey, but whatever, I'll take it. So took it out, shook it, sprayed it. Yeah, and then took the bottle away with me. And it was only afterwards that I realised that even when she was on the podium, she, still thought she'd got the win. So, yeah, it's quite a funny twist to the tale. But you know, it's just a sign of the disorganisation that like a third place rider can even not realise that they've not come first until the winner actually goes out and says, hey, where's my champagne?
That is crazy. I mean, we heard a lot about the sort of disorganisation. It's great to hear you, Lizzie, not afraid to speak out on these issues. You're, as well as winning the stage, I mean, we should talk about your diary, because your diary is fantastic. If people want to listen to the full thing, where can they find it?
So in the latest episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina, there is a very long excerpt from my diary. But even that doesn't capture half of the stories that were in the Giro. And there's so many more stories. And actually, we're going to play a clip now of one of the craziest stories from stage two. And we were about 30 kilometres away from the finish. I was actually off the front. I'd attacked off the front, and Canyon were tracing me down. So we were going down this really fast descent, long, fast descent, super twisty. And my teammate Marlin, she was trying to move Michaela, my other teammate, up, who we were riding for. And she took a corner a little bit too hot and she flew off the edge. And she's going to recount this story to you in a minute. But I just want to explain to you that she flew off the edge and nobody knew where she was. And it was a long, long, long descent. My director, she then thankfully was conscious and was able to talk in the radio. And my director was looking for her, but they got to the bottom of the descent and they couldn't find her. So then you can't drive the wrong way down a race course. So they couldn't you know, the only way that they could go back on and find her was to take two of the bikes off the roof. And then my mechanic and my second DS took two of the bikes off the roof, cycled back the wrong way up the race, and at every single corner were looking over the edge to find her. And they had to go a long, long way up before they eventually found her. But anyway, here's what Marlon had to say about the event.
Awesome, Lizzie. Thank you. I'm so happy I can report on that.
How did it happen? I was off the front, so, and Canyon were chasing behind, weren't they? So what happened?
Yes, Mickey was in the back of the group. Uh-oh. And I decided now we have to bring her to the front because we were close to getting to the next crazy climb there, the gravel climb. So I said to her, take my wheel, and Neve was also on the wheel of Mickey. Take my wheel, we go now, girls. Yeah, and it was, you know, you remember the downhill, it was anyway fast and twisty. So I tried to overpass one rider and she moved. And I took too much risk and she did something not so nice and stupid. And then I touched her wheel and I flew off the side. Yeah, either I was crashing or I was flying off the side, and I decided for the ladder, and then I was saltoing. How you say salto? Like turning. Making a salto.
Oh, somersault.
Huh?
Somersault
in the thorn bush, and I was lying on my back in the thorns, and because I was turning, coming into it, the thorns were wrapped around my legs. One leg was going to the left behind me, one was going to the right, and the bike on the top, and I couldn't get myself out there, and I could barely manage to grab my radio, and yeah, was shit.
And there was a long conversation in the radio in German, and what happened there?
Yeah, I tried to say that I can't get out there, I can't move, and where I am, because they couldn't find me, because I was off the road and nobody had an idea where. And so it took them so long to find me, where I flight. Yeah, they seen how bad I'm wrapped in these thorns, and then they tried to put the thorns away. But the problem was, once they stepped into that area, everything moved and all the thorns moved. Yeah.
Alan is also covered in thorns.
Yeah, I'm so sorry for my rescue team.
But you're okay.
Yeah, I'm really happy that nothing worse than this happened.
Yeah, thank God.
Lizzie, I'm just wondering, you know, you're getting this info. Did you actually see the crash, by the way? Did you see her fly off?
No, so I was off the front of the bunch. Then Marlon was with my teammates Michaela and Neve. Marlon flew off the edge. Neve immediately said into the radio, Marlon's crashed, blah blah blah. But it's so hard to say anything because you've got to remember they're going down a very fast descent, probably 75k an hour, constant hairpins. Michaela heard Neve in the radio, but for some reason, Neve's radio wasn't transmitting to the car. So the car didn't receive the information from Neve. As far as Michaela knew, the car had received the information. So thank God Marlon was still okay and was actually able to speak into her radio and that her radio was working with the car, because it's not uncommon that the radios play up and don't transmit properly. And otherwise it would have been the end of the race, and then they would have said, oh yeah, she flew off at roughly this point, and then she would have been in the bush for 2 hours by that point.
I mean, this is why I'm obsessed with race radio a little bit, because riders are always telling me how often it doesn't, their radios don't work, or they can receive and can't transmit. I've definitely got to do an episode on race radio. I've got to figure out how to do it, how we can record you guys speaking back and forth, but I definitely want to do it. On the Giro though, Lizzie, we've just watched the Tour. The men's Giro is coming up, you know, the races are coming thick and fast. With the Tour, the big thing about the Tour is new product and tech launches, and that's, I'm talking about the men's race here. I wonder whether, and I think I probably know the answer to this, I wonder whether it's the same at the Giro Rosa. Are all the brands lining up to release all this new women's tech?
What do you think, Tom? Not a chance.
With the TV coverage, I would have thought there's very little point, I guess. I mean, I suppose you still get the write-ups and stuff, but yeah, I would think no, not at all.
No, as far as I'm aware, there was no new tech at the Giro. Please, I would love it if some teams wrote in and said, Lizzie, you're wrong, and our sponsors brought this in especially for the Giro. But yeah, I'm afraid not. It's just another example of, yeah, I mean, not even the lack of parity, just the lack of, you know, the lack of exposure and the lack of, I don't know, everything. What's the point in a sponsor bringing in something really big for the women's race? Because the thing is, it's the same partners and sponsors across the board with the men and the women. And if they're going to release something big, you're going to release it at the tour. And that's just a case of viewing numbers. And you know, I'm not holding any grudges at all. It makes sense. If I was a company, I would release it at the tour, not at the Giro. But yeah, I mean, there have been cases where brands have done things like that, and most notably I would say Rafa and all the partners associated with Canyon SRAM, who usually have a special outfit for their women's 100 ride. And this year, obviously with COVID and everything, the women's 100 ride didn't coincide with a big race. But in previous years, it's been, I think last year it was the Women's Tour of Britain, and it was really great to see all the sponsors get on board. They had Canyon do a special paint job for their bikes. Rafa did a full new kit. Giro produced the new helmets and the new design, and it's just such a great thing to see. And the thing is, you do see it filtering through, and you do see people buying this stuff, so it is a good opportunity for marketing for the brands. And yeah, just to release some cool new, it's not really tech, but it looks cool, so yeah, let's call it tech, why not?
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, I'd really love to see that. I mean, I just don't think there is the coverage. It's the coverage, isn't it? You know, you know, we should look at the tour, and there's people taking pictures of all the bikes and sleuthing around trying to find out what the new stuff is. But then again, you know, the difference thing is with the Giro, Rosa, like, the you know, there's so much more potential for there to be new stuff, because, you know, the women's side of the sport is not as developed as the men's. There's so many new things that could be launched.
Yeah, and
it's frustrating.
It doesn't have to just be TV coverage as well. You know, you can, sponsors can and partners can do it through their social media as well. If you decide to launch, like Canyon and Rafa did, Canyon SRAM and Rafa did, if you decide to launch a new kit and outfit, you can spread it across the social media of the team, the bike brand, the helmet brand, the kit brand, and it does get out there to the people, and people do see it, and then it gets onto cycling news websites, and it does get out there. So yeah, of course TV is a very valuable thing, but there are other opportunities and ways of getting things out there. And despite the lack of coverage with the Giro, yeah, I did say, what's the point if it's not on TV? But having said that, you know, we did get a huge amount of coverage for our team during the Giro. When you win a stage of the Giro, even if it's not on TV, obviously the amount of coverage you would get if it was live on ITV in the UK, SBS, whatever, then it would be much, much bigger. But still, like, it is still the most prestigious race. And it's now been downgraded from Women's World Tour to a Point Pro, which is interesting because, you know, a race is as prestigious as riders and people want to make it. And Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, it was a 1.1, but who cares? It was a World Tour race as far as we're concerned, in the way it's raced, the riders that turned up. And just because Omloop Het Nieuwsblad is a 1.1 race, it's never going to lose its prestige. And perhaps the organisers don't want to pay the fees that they have to pay for start fees to the UCI to be a World Tour race. So perhaps they're better to have it as a 1.1, ask the UCI for special dispensation, because usually you're only allowed a number of World Tour teams, and ask for special dispensation to allow them all. And then, yeah, it's kind of win-win for everybody, really. And who cares if it's a 0.1, because we still treat it like a World Tour race.
And actually, I mean, Lizzie, I've got to say, you yourself have had plenty of coverage. I've been reading about you in a lot of magazines and on a lot of sites. And with that, it comes the added problem of people making the cardinal sin of spelling it with an I-E and not a Y.
Yeah, well, you know, yeah, I'm not Lizzie Dagnan, unfortunately. Maybe I wish I was, but my name, you listeners out there, if you're going to spell my name, please spell it with a Y. Otherwise, you're on my black mark list.
I've been going back through all our messages just to see if I've made any mistakes. I'm bound to have somewhere. Lizzie, one thing we were chatting about, you've sort of had your eye on new tech and new maybe new trends in cycling. And we talked about saddles in last month's show. And you think there has been sort of a bit of a change in the way saddles are designed, or a new trend coming?
Yeah, definitely. So we were talking about saddles last month, and we really really barely scratched the surface of kind of saddle technology, and there's so much more to talk about. You know, you could look into chamois technology, chamois cream. It's just we're doing more. We're coming back, so don't worry. And it is something I get asked about a lot, and people ask me what saddle I ride. And for all you out there who want to know, I ride an Adamo PN 3.0, but that does not mean that it's the saddle that's right for you. That is the thing about saddles. Everybody's ass is different and your requirements are different. And it's really important to just kind of, yeah, try it out and don't settle for something that's not right. But something that I have noticed is Physique just released a new saddle called the Vento Argo R5, catchy as ever. And it's a short nose saddle and it's got a very, very similar profile to the Specialized Power saddle. The central cutout almost looks identical. I think from what I've been reading about is that it's a little harder than the Specialized Power saddle, but the stubbiness of its nose and the shortness of its design and the central cutout is really something that we're beginning to see a theme in, and perhaps it's going to become the fashion in saddles, but not because it's just a fashion, because it's actually working a lot better for a lot more people. So it'll be interesting to see if other saddle brands go the same way. I'm almost surprised that they were allowed to make it, to be honest, because looking at it, it looks so similar to the Power saddle, but I don't really know the rules about intellectual property with copying other people's saddles.
No, I mean, well, we see this with frames, don't we? You know, all the frames pretty much look the same.
They're
design
all the same.
These days, don't they?
Yeah,
they're all the same, aren't they? Yeah.
Even when you test frames in wind tunnel, the difference between them is so minimal. It really, you know, if you're looking at X number of aero frames or X number of kind of climbing bikes, really the difference is so, so minimal that it's the rider's body that makes the difference between kind of aerodynamic gains and how the carbon is actually laid up in terms of where it's compliant and where it's not, and the ride feel and stuff like that. So that's more what makes a difference than the look of it, really, or the weight. You know, the weight of them is going to be all really much of a muchness, and pretty much any frame these days you're going to be able to get down to the UCI weight limit.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Hi Lizzie, sorry to butt in again to the service course, another riveting episode, but I'm here, and that was Seb Piquet, who we just heard from, interrupting to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Babbel, the language learning app. And I'm here because I've been using it, and so I think have you, Lizzie.
I have indeed, and I have another question for you, Richard. Che tipo di sport preferisci?
Ciclismo.
Ah, certo, of course, we all prefer cycling. Well, that was the lesson that I was doing today on Babbel. What type of sports do you prefer? And I think we all know the answer to that one.
Oh, I hope so. I certainly hope so. Your life would be easier if that were the case. That's handy because I'm off to Italy tomorrow for the Giro d'Italia. But, I mean, Lizzie, you are a maybe keen Italian scholar is pushing it a bit. But, you know, speaking foreign languages must be a very important part of your job, I guess, or at least being able to get by, ask for a coffee and things like that.
Yeah, I think being able to say a few words in a lot of different languages is really valuable. I don't speak any languages fluently, and during lockdown this year, I decided that it was time for me to start learning a language, and I started learning Italian. And actually, I started using Babbel during lockdown, and just doing a 15-minute lesson a day and learning a little bit every day really allowed me to, come a really long way in quite a short time. And I've just come back from a successful trip to Italy, if you didn't already know, and I was using my Italian a lot there, and really it's amazing how much I've learned from just doing bite-sized chunks every day but keeping it regular.
I'm not sure if Babbel teaches you how to swear in Italian, which probably is quite useful in a bike race.
No, Babbel doesn't teach you how to swear, but you know, there are certain tips and tricks that you can only pick up from your teammates.
Well, Babbel is the language learning app. As I said, it's designed to get to quickly get you speaking a new language within weeks with daily 10 to 15 minute lessons. It teaches real life conversations and you learn through interactive dialogues. Lessons are created by over 100 language experts, real people, not machines. And you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. It's also great fun. I use it too. It's if you you know, do your 15-minute daily lesson. It's not, it doesn't feel like a chore. It does feel like quite good fun. And right now, Babbel is offering our listeners 6 months free with a purchase of a 6-month subscription with the promotion code CYCLE. Go to babbel.co.uk/play and use the promo code CYCLE on your 6-month subscription. That's Babbel, babbel.co.uk/play, promo code CYCLE.
Well, here I am once again, channeling my inner Philip Marlowe, sleuthing on the hunt for the Adidas Le Criterium de Dauphiné hoodie that I saw on a couple of episodes of the first season of Spaced, which I've been watching during lockdown. I've not made a huge amount of progress since last month's episode. I've not met any smoking men in car parks with any information, but I did get an email. I'm going to read it out to you. This is from Martin Hurd, who I believe used to be an Adidas archivist. And he says, having cycling gear as props seems to be a thing. Just think about the iconic Brooklyn cap and Spike Lee. Anyone who's seen Do the Right Thing will know about that. So he says, the hoodie is definitely vintage. Based on the type of trefoil and the font, it's from the late 70s or early 80s. Unfortunately, you won't find much more about it, as it was common to supply all kinds of events with random apparel for volunteers back then. This is why you get items like this with prints from marathons, TNF meetings or cycling races in vintage stores. The French Adidas department was big in this kind of low-key sponsoring, and they were also the ones to take care of the cycling category, so a volunteer's hoodie for a French bike race makes total sense. I'm lucky to own a 1980 Tour de France t-shirt, and it's the same story. He's attached a picture which we'll post on our socials. So beyond that, he goes on to say that on period photography, you can also spot lots of Adidas rain jackets and tracksuits at the Tour de France and other races. For jerseys, however, pros like Merckx stayed traditional and did the same as they did with their bikes. They rebranded, so lots of Castelli or Santini jerseys became Adidas after adding three stripes to the shoulders, but that is another story. That's one perhaps we'll pick up on at a later date. So anyway, thanks, Martin. Anyone else with any more information on this Adidas hoodie that I'm trying to track down, please get in touch. I'm at Tom_Wally on Twitter. The plot thickens. Well, as you were talking about there about how, you know, bikes, all of them pretty much cut the same silhouette these days. They all look pretty similar. I know Cannondale was one of the sort of held out a bit longer with their design, but that's changed now. There is a new bike brand on the block. It's been launched by Ivan Basso and Alberto Contador. It's called Aurum, which I believe is Spanish or for gold. Is that
it's
right?
Latin for gold.
So I didn't do classics in my school, in my comprehensive.
It's all right. You've got a posh girl here just to help you out.
So that brand has just been launched, and I actually sat down and spoke with Alberto Contador and Ivan Basso to talk about the brand and why they launched it. So about you two guys then, your friendship, when did it start between the two of you? Was it when you rode together in 2007 with Discovery, or were you friends before that?
Well, we met in 2007, but it's a strange moment for me. So our relation is always friendly, but we don't know each other in a strong way. We have lucky, I always say too late, because I think also for myself, if I meet Alberto a few years before, I can give more support in the last years of him, because after 2012 my performance start to go down, but I think in these years, if I make a support for a champion, I can do better. But in the end, in my last 2 years bike rider, and his last 2 years. So in these 4 years, before I'm a roommate, and later in the staff, we can put this friendship solid and share experience of our career. And we know we have almost a different motor. His motor is much better than mine, but same philosophy, same idea of cycling, same attitude. And in the end, we start to think, okay, we meet too late, by like a bike rider, but we meet very soon in the new life. So we are lucky to start to think something new.
So, I mean, you two work together in all sorts of fields. So obviously you've got the bike brand, which we will talk a lot about. But also, Ivan, you are a director for Alberto's team. So how does that relationship work? So I guess, Alberto, you're his boss. Is that right?
Yes. Sometimes they are the team, they do a joke with me that be careful because the president is here. And the final the teams are the foundation Alberto Contador. Yeah, and we are working very hard because it's not easy, you know, have a sponsor for these teams. We are working also with the jump riders, with junior under 23, the last year continental, and the next year we will be a team continental professional. And it's a very good news for us. Finally, it's important that the riders can go up year by year, and also it's a good opportunity for the bicycle, no? Because the Aurum will be part of the team, and also this year was crucial for the bicycle because they do more than half a million of kilometers. In all condition, and with some crash, very hard at the race. The weather, you know, always is good, and I think that was a very important test. And for the next year, maybe they can have a good results at the race. Also, is some part and big work for Ivan.
Yes, because you have to know, we have another boss up of us. So we have one brother, the brother of Alberto. You don't see so much, but he solo is there. So we have one person up to the president.
I mean, one thing about having the team, that must be quite helpful when you're going to launch a brand, because in terms of rider feedback, you've got so many people that you can speak to.
Yes, for us the feedback of the team is very important. It's true that the when we start with this project of the prototypes, the test on the road was with Ivan and me. The final, you try many different brands, the leader of the market, and you have a big experience, no? But after the different prototypes, when we take the decision, now we have the bicycle. At the middle of January, all the riders start with the bicycle, and also we try with some components. And the different teams try with another components, maybe a small low level. And the feedback was incredible. And our team in the last year was with Trek, but the rider are this year very, very happy with the bicycle. Also, I can see the difference, you know, when you have a very bad crash, if the bicycle broke, where it broke, exactly what's the situation, the speed, everything. And for us, it's very important, no? Because when you put the bicycle in the market after more than half million, after stay at the wind tunnel, after Everesting challenge, after stay at the truck for a road bike, is not always this situation.
Oh, that's interesting. So I mean, we saw you do the Everesting challenge. Was that part of a little test for the bike as well then? Was that part of development?
I also do Everesting, but the slower. Do the record, how many do, how the opposite one. So we have both.
Oh, the you have the Lantern Rouge for Everesting as well. That's good. So that was part of the testing process then?
Yes, exactly. No, and not only for the uphill, was also for the descent, because my Everesting was maybe not the best situation for do a record, because it was in July and in Madrid it's 40 degrees, it's not the best condition, and also it's very hard have a good road close with the average percent that is good for you without the corners. Of course, you put at the limit every lap. For us was important because also you put in the aero position, and I finished very happy, but also I finished very, very tired. No, in the first moment, I think this can be easy. My bicycle in this situation is more or less 6.2 kilo, good clincher, everything. Yeah, I think that will be very, very hard. But the last six laps, to me, was very, very hard. Also, it's true that I don't train in the same that in the past. But it's not a small challenge. Eh? It's a bigger challenge.
Normally, when a rider retires and starts their own bike brand, it's just one of them. You know, it's Merckx, it's Le Monde, countless people have done it. But with this one, there's two of you. So when it comes to designing bikes, do you guys have different styles, and how do you bring those things together?
Well, that is a good point. It's a good question. We don't... I think the difference is not just build a bike. It's not because if you want just build a bike, it's something already old. You have to work hard and not build a bike. You have to build the best bike is possible and the in the market. That is the difference. But it's the same approach when we are a rider. You don't go to the race. You go to the race for win. And our approach on the bike is not just do a bike. Otherwise, if you won't do this, it's much better go ambassador of one company. It's more easy and less pain in the head. So we want to not do like the example you mentioned. We want to try, of course, and to build the best bike is possible with experience, with professional people with us, and like you said before, our experience, we don't have also an important point, you can understand what I say. Not, we have bike project from the school, bike school to the county professional team. So all that we have in Spain, we have in Italy, we own the team, we own the bike company, we try to have all together, and that is in our head is what is the difference. We trust in what we do and we put all our energy with ourselves, but also with the people with us.
I want another question, Ivan. I want to ask you, next year when the team are riding on bikes, you know, your own brand, at some point, one of those riders is going to cross the line first, stick their arms up in the air. How is that moment, you know, going to compare with some of the great moments in your career?
Yeah, I think what I is almost connected to the question like before. I think when we see with one rider of us win the stage in the Giro with our bike, I think is of course it may is different emotion, but still something really strong and new for us. I don't know exactly what, but is we want to try this emotion. We work for this, and for sure, all the team, not only me and Alberto, we wait this moment, and we work for this moment come true.
For sure, will be very special because I think that all the moment is very special when you work a lot before, no, for take this objective. But it's true that for us the objective is not only the victories of the professional team; it's also that the people can enjoy of a faster bike of the market, a bicycle that they make with the experience of the two pro riders, more than 30 years in the more important race of the world, and a bicycle that we do is from a rider to the cyclotourist. It's not from the brand to the rider, and after go to the market. And I think that this is also a very important point.
And then, well, I mean, final question then. We've seen the Magma, which is the first frame that you're launching, which is a top end road bike. What are your ambitions for the brand? Will there be a time trial bike? Will you be doing gravel? You know, that seems to be the big thing. I mean, what are your ambitions?
Yeah, the ambition is very high, and we have a lot of idea. Now we run for the gravel model, but what we can say now is the development of the gravel frame. We use the same system, we use the same approach, we try to get information from specialist rider good on the off-road, and because we want to when this bike go to the market, we have to be sure, like we are sure with Magma.
Lizzie, there's been quite a trend, really. It's been sort of a tradition, really. Riders are successful in the men's side of things. They leave the sport and they launch a brand with their name on it in massive letters. Obviously, Alberto Contador and Van Basso is slightly different. We've not seen two people do it together, I don't think, before. And they haven't, you know, they've got a different brand. It's called Aurum. But and the women's side of things, I can't think of many women in the sport who've launched their own range of bikes. Are there any out there?
So Victoria Pendleton released a range, I think it was in association with Halfords, and that was more of a kind of town bike, leisure bike range. Recently in mountain biking, Rachel Atherton, who was with Trek for many, many, many years, she's just launched Atherton bikes. And so obviously those are mountain bikes only. I don't know if you can actually buy them yet. I'm not sure because it was released last year. Other than that, I can't recall any off the top of my head, but it is interesting, isn't it? You know, you've got Merckx, Boardman. Boardman's big in the UK. Actually, Boardman's sold out now. He's sold to somebody else, but the name is still there. I'm sure he still owns a small amount of it, but it's not as much as he did. Cipollini. You know, Cipollini is a big frame. Who else have we got? I'm trying to think.
Le Monde.
Yeah.
Hoy, Le Monde.
Oh, Hoy, yeah.
It's got, and there's quite a few. And obviously, I mean, back in time, there's, you know, a lot of ex-racers might not have had the same sort of profile, but might have launched a small steel frame brand that, you know, was maybe big in their sort of region. But yeah, I do think there's an opportunity, isn't there, for people like, you know, I mean, who's about to retire? Is Van der Breggen about to retire?
Yeah, she's going to retire at the end of after the 2021 Olympics. So and then Chantal Black's going to retire just the year after. So maybe they could do a Black Van der Breggen brand. But you know what? I actually think the bike frame market is pretty crowded. I mean, perhaps it's such a good market to go into that it doesn't really matter if it's crowded. Someone will buy it. But I think there's other things that you could go into that, I don't know, clothing is also, it's also a crowded market, but it's also something that's very lucrative. And yeah, if you're kind of buying into a person as a brand, then it's something that's a bit more accessible than buying a bike frame because it's so expensive.
Oh, well, I'm just wondering, really. I mean, what I was building towards is, when am I going to be riding a Banks frame?
I don't think you're going to be finding yourself on a Banks frame in the next 20 years. Maybe, I don't know. What might I release? I think I'm better at doing DIY. So I think, Tom, you might find me Banks carpeting. And if you're doing some renovations on your house, you get me over for that instead.
Oh, I'm looking forward to using my Banks power sander and a cordless drill.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thanks as ever to Science in Sport for powering the Cycling Podcast and Service Course. I know Rich has recently been speaking to James Morton from Science in Sport to put your questions about nutrition to him. And I actually missed the boat, but if I was going to ask a question at the moment, it'd be, can I still justify having a Science in Sport Rego recovery drink if I only ride for about half an hour? Because my rides are getting shorter and shorter with family life getting more complex. But I still, those Rego drinks are just, well, they're perfect when you finish a big ride. Even when I finish a small ride, I seem to be drinking them. So, yeah, that's my question to James. Get back to me. If you want to get 25% off your next order with Science in Sport, you can do it by going to scienceinsport.com and entering the offer code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Right, OK, so we're still in the kind of post-tour, post-Giro Rosa world. I know we are heading into the next Grand Tour, and it's going to get very, very busy. But we're still in that kind of world. And one of the things we did a little bit last month was look at some of the tech at the Tour. And I've had a sort of another look at what people were using. There's been a bit more information come out. But one thing I'm always interested in is trends in cycling. And someone wins on a certain bike or does a certain thing, and that trend then tends to permeate the rest of the peloton, whether it's sock length or glasses, gloves, no gloves, whatever. It does tend to permeate. And then obviously it filters through into us ordinary cyclists. And one thing I was looking back on sort of the bikes that had been used to win the Tour. And there was a big splash when, I think it was when Froome won his first Tour, about asymmetric chain rings. You know, Froome was one of the first sort of early adopters of those. And I got to thinking about, well, looking at this year's Tour, I didn't spot many, if any, at all. And I was wondering why that sort of, that little bit of success hasn't led to a greater trend. But you told me that you actually ride asymmetric chain rings.
That's true. Our whole team are on oval chain rings. We're supported by Rota and we all ride them. And yeah, it's slightly different for all of us because Rota have five different positions that you can put your chain rings in, and you ride and you use their app to kind of determine where in the pedal phase you put most power down, and then that tells you to put your chain rings in a certain position. So yeah, it's quite interesting. I've been using them for almost 2 years now. It's really hard because I'm not going to say I notice a huge difference, but that's because I'm not going from one to the other, and I have no problems with them, and I find my pedal stroke is quite smooth. The thing that was a bit weird is when you start using them and it kind of feels almost like you're jumping, and then within I'd say one or two rides, I was completely used to it. And now I'm just so used to it that if I went back to round rings, I would again feel a bit like I was jumping, and I'm sure I would then get used to it again. But yeah, I mean, I've re-signed with my team for another 2 years, so I'm going to be on them for at least another 2 years now. So yeah, I like them, but it's a very difficult thing to kind of objectively say whether it's good or bad, because it's just so difficult when you just ride one thing and that's what you're used to.
Well, I spoke to Borat Fonda from Absolute Black, who is definitely on the side of oval rings or asymmetric rings are better. And he's going to explain exactly why and talk a little bit about why there hasn't sort of been more riders adopting them. But when I spoke to Borat, I didn't actually know where in the world he was. It turned out he was in Slovenia. So obviously I asked him the obvious questions about Slovenian cyclists. And it was quite enlightening what he had to say. It turns out he knows all of them. So let's listen to Borat.
I mean, what's happening at the moment, it's absolutely hectic. I cannot tell you, like, I mean, my business went well, but then I was on national TV the other day because I work with about 7 pro tier teams that are currently with Graphenloop. We supply their chains, and someone told out to the TV, they came here with the crew. They filmed for about a minute and a half, but it was aired at the peak time, I think like at 8 in the evening during the news. My phone's been ringing, I mean, nonstop. And we have a population of 2 million, you know, so it's not like a big pool of people, even if there's a lot of cyclists, it's still, but it's crazy. At the moment, this time of day, this is just superb.
How do you, I mean, this is not why we're talking, but I can't ignore it. Why do you think this is happening to Slovenia at the moment? What is this perfect storm that's come together to create all these riders?
I think it'd be consistency. You know what? Because I would not. We're small, yes, but we have a lot of good riders. We had them in past. We had, but never had like the top at the top of the world. So it was more of a question of a time rather than, is it gonna happen? Like, okay, Roglic, he's a phenomenon. Like him, it's hard to explain. I don't think ever is gonna happen, or it's gonna happen in 1,000 years in any other countries, that you start with cycling at such a late age, but you're just gifted, you know. But then with Tadej Pogacar, he was just like everything lined perfect. I mean, we're looking at, he started the right time. He was raised by his parents in a way that you need to work hard, so disciplinary way. And his mentality is not all about the money. It's basically he's racing for a result, not for a for fame. And then when you combine all those with a natural talent, of course, that you cannot neglect, then you have world-class riders as you have it now. Yes, Slovenia, we're just basically building up. Obviously, we have, the population is that much smaller that we don't have that many riders, but those who actually succeed and get the opportunity are really good riders. And on a different note, like what changed in past 20 years? In past, I think it was a lot about the teams that they were pushing forward their local riders. So Italian teams, they would always put Italian riders to be their star riders. French, they would put French riders, etc., etc. Slovenia was always too small to have their own team. So now where things actually got equal, that this country issues is no longer an issue, then I think we're just being enabled to show what we can.
I'm guessing it's a small world. So do you know Roglic or Pogacar at all? You work with them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Roglic, I've actually never met him in person. As in, I do work with the team, with their performance manager. Whereas with Tadej, yeah, we're friends. And I mean, he's been here in the lab several times. I work with the entire team UAE as an official biomechanics consultant. So I help them up with biomechanics. We supply them with chains. So basically with Tadej and other UAE members, I know them in person.
So, well, let's get to it then. That's obviously Absolute Black. I mean, we were talking about you the other week because anything that happens with graphene, we're interested in on this podcast. And when I heard about the lube, I spoke to sort of my contacts, one of whom publishes a graphene journal. I said, have you seen this? And he hadn't actually seen it. I said, will you look into it for me? Because you know what graphene's like. Sometimes it's graphene, sometimes it's graphite. And he came straight back and went, you know, this is bleeding edge. This is proper graphene stuff. So that's when you kind of first sort of crossed our radar. But tell us a bit more about Absolute Black and the work you do and who you work with.
Okay, so Absolute Black was founded by, I think, a few years ago and started with oval chainrings. So the owner had an idea how he can change the way people pedal by changing the diameter, the shape of an oval chainring. And that this is how it all started. But obviously it got to quite a big success fairly quickly. Good sales and obviously funding to invest into other fields. So from the biomechanical point of view, there was some clear task that I need to do. And mainly it's testing and just redefinement of the process that we already do regarding oval chainrings and also the graphene loop. My role is purely as scientist and development, so scientific research, development, testing the existing stuff and some of the new products that we're hopefully going to be launching in about a year and a half, that we think that might be even a bigger boom than graphene as it is at the moment. We're speaking products that have nothing to do with looping, but in general, biomechanics and cycling. So with me coming aboard, also one of the roles I had was to be a LEA with Pro Tour teams, because I have worked in past with professional athletes, professional teams, to basically make that bridge between practice and science. And it's just been wonderful because, okay, unfortunately for the Corona year, but Corona actually allowed us to use that time to give riders to test specific setups, specific equipments, to gain feedback on the world tour level, you know, because when Tadej Pogacar tests something for you, it's something completely different than if a recreational amateur cyclist tests that and gives you feedback. So it's been great in a way. So we actually used the advantage of a lockdown and tested a lot of equipment on professional athletes as well during this time.
So I mean, so when you talk about sort of, I mean, we'll get onto some of the more the products that you make, but in terms of biomechanics then, so when you work with Tadej, is that, I mean, are you literally trying to refine his position, or is that what it boils down to all the time?
So yeah, I mean, with Tadej, we spent quite some time refining position. So it all started in December in Benidorm on a group training camp. So one of my personal interest in past, and I'm also the author of the patent, are six component force torque sensor pedals. So basically we have force pedals that are completely diagnostic equipment and can measure 3D forces at the pedals and 3D torques. So basically at a very high frequency at the same time. And we can combine this with a 3D motion capturing system to get complete knee loading, basically everything we need to see. Where is the power coming from? How the rider is pushing, where they're losing the energy, etc., etc. That combined with some of the pressure mapping technology from Gibiomized, we basically have everything, a comprehensive insight into how people actually pedal. And then we try to find the position on the bike to make them the most effective as possible. And this is a major breakthrough in cycling science because we don't follow some standards, as in what knee angle or whatever angle it needs to be. It goes completely away from that. It basically looks at an individual, how they pedal and where that individual is the most effective and or most efficient in a way. So when we brought that equipment to Benidorm, I think all riders and staff were quite impressed. So Tadej actually came back here in Slovenia for a few more times to redefine that. Plus on the time trial, we did it in Valencia on a velodrome. So combining the knowledge on aerodynamics from different outsourced from a guy from Germany, Lars, who looks at the aerodynamics, and then us putting not to lose it on the account of aerodynamics, lose it on the effectiveness point of view. So this actually made the day as one very effective rider on a time trial bike. So
well, I mean, you're working to improve him. He's what, 21 years old? Is that right? 21?
I think he's turning 22 this year. Yeah, he's 21. Yeah.
So, I mean, he's probably still there's probably still a huge amount of improvement that he can find, and that's frightening.
Yeah. I'm a scientist, and I know quite a lot about physiology as well. And to be honest, you know, when I'm looking at numbers of most of those guys, not just today, I get impressed and shocked. Like, how is this even possible? Really, but it is. I mean, when all those factors that we talked at the beginning kind of combine and interact in the most positive way, you get something out that's like today. So I think he will gain a lot more, even in terms of efficiency, that he's going to be just more, even more efficient in the future. I think this boy can really rule the Tour de France and the races for the next 10, 15 years if all goes well. I mean, subject to objective ways, as in crashes and that we cannot really control for. But yeah, it's amazing. He can, but it's his mentality. He always wants to go this, like the final percentage down. I think in cycling, it's quite popular, the term of marginal gain. He really is into that. So he's going to go every, he's going to experiment. He's going to try if it's going to help and he's going to use it. So it's an absolute joy working with him.
Well, I mean, that leads us on to sort of the next thing I want to talk about. I mean, I'm very, very interested to see what you've got. You know, you're saying next year you might launch some very revolutionary products. But one of the things I want to talk about, we've been watching the Tour de France, and obviously anyone with an eye on cycling tech looks towards the Tour de France, you know, the new products and what people are riding. Oval chain rings have played a big role in Tour de France history. Chris Froome, huge fan. But not necessarily something that's caught on across the whole of the peloton. And I was just wondering why you think that might be.
Oh, it's a very clear reason. It's not even guessing. I mean, you have to know the drivetrain manufacturers, Shimano, SRAM, Campagnolo, they pay big monies to be involved with those teams. And there's only a few teams that are either buying the group sets or just getting them for free, not getting any money for it. So it's pure sponsorship issue. So in order to be part of the World Tour game, you have to chip in with a lot of money as well. So hopefully this is going to change in the next season already. I don't want to give you that specifics, but there is a lot of interest coming from the World Tour teams to get their riders on oval chain rings. I mean, people have tried, they read their science out. I mean, almost every single team has a sports scientist now within the team who's looking for improvements like that. I get daily queries about, can you send test rings and so on and so on. So I think it's just a matter of time and renegotiating the contracts with the manufacturers of the drivetrain components in order to allow riders to use aftermarket chain rings, for example. Now, with Chris Froome, that obviously wasn't an issue because it was such a high priority for him that they've negotiated that out with, I think, Shimano in all his years. But I don't think the other riders were allowed to use any other chain rings apart from him. So
my co-presenter, actually, Lizzie Banks, she's an elite rider in the women's tour, and their team, she rides for a Keep Paul car. They all use oval chain rings, which I didn't realise at the time when we were talking about this. But I think around the time of when Chris Froome was sort of first winning the Tour, they were very startling and everyone was like, well, wow, what are those and how do they work? In the interim, I've kind of forgotten. And I think a lot of it was a sort of speculation, scientists trying to sort of retrofit, you know, work out how they work. But as someone who's involved in the day-to-day side of things, what is the advantage of an oval chain ring?
Okay, let's just first play. There's a big difference between different manufacturers. So we have what Chris Froome's been using with Osymmetric and what Absolute Black is doing. It's completely the opposite thing. I mean, not going to say completely the opposite, but very, very different.
Right.
As all Osymmetric chain rings are eccentric. They're not oval. They're not a perfect ellipse. Whereas Absolute Black, it's a perfect ellipse, it's 100% ellipse, which means it's completely symmetric and it's oval. So the ovality for Absolute Black is around 9%, plus minus a few percent, depending on what type of the chainring we're looking at. And the most important parameter is the timing. That's the major axis orientation. In plain terms, what's the crank position when the chainring is the biggest? So I don't know if you remember, oval chainring started, I think, in 1978 with Shimano Biopace. They launched the oval chainrings. I mean, non-circular chainring, to be exact. But they absolutely killed the market because the way they were designed, they were complete opposite, like 90% different to what we have now with Absolute Black. And a lot of people actually got hurt and got slower. So the market went quiet for many years, and then other manufacturers followed Absolute Black as well. So Absolute Black major axis orientation of the oval channeling is at around 110 degrees crank position. So that's past the 90 degree. So the way our oval channeling is designed, it adapts to a power profile of a cyclist. So it's the bigger when you're stronger and it's smaller when you're weaker. Basically, this is how it adapts. That's why a lot of people actually report, and from the latest study we carried out here in Slovenia, we actually proved that it also unloads the knee, which means if you have knee pain, it actually could be solved with an oval chainring just by itself, because it's going to put more load to the hip, involving the glute muscles to a larger extent. So why does it work? Is basically because it adapts to your power profile. And one of the comments, like you could often get from a cyclist who just about to enter, just about to start using oval chainrings, that pedaling actually feels more circular in plain terms, even though the chainring is not circular, but it just feels circular. And the biggest difference when you find it is when you actually go back to the round chainring, the normal chainring. You just feel something's breaking you every single pedaled revolution. Because the difference is not, again, it's not small, it's quite substantial. When you measure it accurately and you control for all the variables, you leave people to adapt to a certain degree, the difference is quite, it's not marginal.
Lizzie, there was a lot in that interview. I'm just going to throw over to you now, because you've, as always, you do your research, Lizzie. You do it properly.
Oh, yeah. Well, like I was saying before the interview, the thing that I think is quite interesting is that, so with Rota, there are five different positions that you can put your chain rings in. And Borat was saying that they only have one position. And he was also saying that they've tested it and they've worked out like the best position for cycling. And that he was saying that he teaches his athletes to pedal in a different way, which is quite interesting. So I wonder if they find, if what they found through their research is that this is the most efficient way. And then over a long period of time, you know, you would have to take a whole off season for this. You'd have to start right at the beginning of the off season and then really train yourself to pedal differently. That they found kind of big changes in the efficiency of the pedal strokes. But he also quoted a study that he did, and I'm not trying to dismiss the validity of what he's saying. I just wanted to look into a little bit more. So I've had a look at the study, which is free to access on their website. And the study that they did, it used seven cyclists. So, you know, we're looking at a very small testing number to begin with. And it's cyclists who were riding between 3 and 10,000 kilometres a year, which, you know, when you're talking pro levels, is really not very much. And I think the thing that's interesting about that is if you take any cyclist who's only riding 3 to 10,000 kilometers a year and you do something specific with them in terms of their training, you're almost always going to find an improvement whatever you do, because you'll probably be upping the amount of training that they're doing and they probably haven't done anything specific. But yeah, it's showing supposedly a statistically significant improvement, but there's not a kind of before and after comparison, and it's only seven riders, so I'm not really sure you can say something statistically significant if there's seven riders. So it's interesting, because I rate oval chain rings. I love riding with oval chain rings. That's not to say I wouldn't love riding with round chain rings, but I do like riding with the oval ones I have. But it's interesting when companies say, you know, we've got this study and it proves this, because looking into it, I'm not really sure it proves that much, to be honest.
Well, you wanted to say something more. I mean, that we the reason we're talking about that is because, you know, I thought oval chain rings would be a big trend in cycling. And hey, it may yet. That still may be the case. But you wanted to say something else about trends in cycling.
Yeah, absolutely. When you were talking about trends before, it really struck me about a trend that I've seen this year in the women's peloton. And I'm going to talk about Annemiek again. Please, Annemiek, don't think I'm picking on you, because I really admire you as a cyclist, and, you know, you're the world's best cyclist for a reason. So with Annemiek, it's no secret that she trains a lot of hours, and it really works for her. As you can see, she's number one in the world. But I've seen a trend in that across the peloton. And I think that actually what's interesting is I think some people are burning out because they're doing too many hours and they're increasing their hours too fast. And especially what with the situation with lockdown, people are doing a lot more kind of long hours than they normally were. Of course, you're not traveling and you're not racing and you've not got that kind of fatigue from that you usually have. But if you usually do 17 hours a week and suddenly you're doing 24 week after week, that is going to add up and you may not notice that until it's too late. So, yeah, I would encourage people to kind of look into the evidence for things and not always do something because it works for a winner, because everybody is different. And the reason high training volume works for Annemiek is because she is an older athlete. She's 37, going on 38, I think. And she's had a huge number of years to be able to condition her body and slowly build this up. You know, there was a very interesting interview back during lockdown period with Orla and Annemiek and her coach about how they did this. But I think for younger cyclists, they are thinking, oh, wow, you know, the way people get good is by doing 6 hours after 6 hours after 6 hours. And Lizzie Deignan is an excellent voice for saying this isn't necessary. Lizzie Deignan trains short hours and she trains intensity. Personally, I have probably a mixture of both of those. I definitely don't do the hours that Annemiek does. And I do like doing some long days, but I also do short days and high intensity. And I think having that balance works for me. But yeah, what I really want to say is don't always follow the crowd because it's not necessarily right for you. And often, as Borat was saying, you know, a lot of teams are paid to use something. And so the reason that they're winning on something isn't necessarily because the product is amazing. It's probably because the team's being paid to use it.
Well, Lizzie, that brings us to a neat end for this month's episode. You are, hopefully, fingers crossed, we'll next see you hitting out at Flanders and Roubaix. Before we go, I was just wondering, actually, you know, these are big cobbled races. Roubaix, it's the first time it's the first time it's been run for the women. Will we see any new tech? Are you going to be doing anything interesting with your setups for bikes for those races?
I'm not sure I should sell my secrets yet because I don't want all the other teams to cotton on. But no, I mean, of course, each team has their own sponsor commitments. But we've got some pretty sick tyres from Vittoria, let's just say that. So we've got these 30mm tyres that are really beefy, really cool. And I haven't ridden the Roubaix course, but the riders I've spoken to in the peloton who have say that it's just something else. You know, they say it's really going to be a high risk race. And Thomas, our director, says, you know, there's going to be at least 6 to 10 broken bones. And I think that's true. And it's a race that you have to ride from the front and it is a very dangerous race. And as I've heard, the cobbles are like nothing you've ever seen. But that excites me, and I love the challenge of stuff like that. I always do kind of crazy mountain biking type stuff on my road bike. And just for the listeners, I want to update you that I got a tubeless kit from the service course when I was over at the service course, and I am going to be going tubeless this off-season. So yeah, that was a bit of an aside, but yeah, we've got some really good tyres in the pipeline. And oh, I don't know, maybe we'll double wrap bar tape or something. I was talking to Lizzie Deignan at Worlds and she was saying she might wear two pairs of shorts.
Well, do you know what? If she wins, we'll all be wearing two pairs of shorts. That's yeah. How these things work.
The whole winter,
it?
Everyone will be saying, oh God, I can't believe you've been riding with only one pair of shorts. You know that all the winners wear two.
Well, fingers crossed it happens, Lizzie, because I actually think that's a race that is made for you. I just think it appealed to that side, that adventurous side of your riding.
And you know what, at the end of October, whoa, we're gonna have some good weather.
I mean, you are such an advocate for riding in horrible conditions. So like, I just think it's made for you. So yeah, fingers crossed that happens. And what's beyond that, Lizzie, actually? I haven't asked you. What's beyond that for the rest of the season?
Well, the Paris-Roubaix isn't actually the final race on the calendar. The Madrid Challenge is the 6th till the 8th of November. But that's obviously really up in the air right now. We'll see if the Vuelta goes ahead and the Madrid Challenge as well. So we don't know. Obviously, races are getting cancelled already, so it really depends. We're just not quite sure when the off season's going to start. So at some point the races will end and I will take a holiday of sorts. And then, just get preparing for the 2020 Olympic season in 2021.
And the launch of Banks Tools, or
yeah,
whatever they're called.
Banks Cordless Drill. Look out for it.
Well, Lizzie, let's go. I think, shall we leave it with another excerpt from your diary?
Yeah, absolutely. So here's a little excerpt from... Another little excerpt from the carnage of the Giro Rosa. And if you'd like to listen to the whole diary, please go and listen to the latest episode of the cycling podcast, Femina.
I recommend that you do that. Lizzie, I'll see you soon.
Thanks, Tom. See you. Going down the descent, one rider from Movistar had just attacked off the front, so it was like perfect. I went first wheel, Michaela second wheel, no stress, just really easy descent. And then halfway down the descent, I'm first wheel, white jersey is behind me. I just stack it, like, I have no idea why, going around this hairpin bend. Well, I do know why afterwards, but there seemed to be no reason. Like, I didn't have my brakes on, we weren't, like, on the edge, anything at all. So suddenly I'm, like, upside down on the tarmac in the middle of the road, my bike's on top of me, and the other 95 people are just about to come around the hairpin, and it's really difficult. You, like, stand up, and then, you know, I immediately just tried to get on my back of my bike, but my chain was off, and thank God nobody else came down. And then you, like, you can't move to the side of the road because there's people coming, and then there's people coming on both sides of you, and oh my God, it's so hectic. And so thankfully my bike was okay, I just bent the shifter in, so I jumped back on the bike and then caught onto the back of the peloton. And I, you know, we couldn't do a bike change there because it was, we were car five because we're fifth on GC, but it was just, you know, it was straight down the descent, and I'd have got dropped because at the bottom of the descent it went straight into a crosswind section, and then the whole climb was so exposed. So we got to the bottom of the descent, and then there was a moment, so we did a really quick bike change, but it was really funny because so my second DS jumped out of the car. I'd like stopped, put my bike down, second DS jumped out of the car, then it was on a really narrow stretch of road, and then on the side of the road it just like went down into this thorny ditch. Alan and my mechanic jumped out of the car to get my bike, and then like Alan and Stephen, my DS, like crashed into each other, and then Alan fell down this ditch with my spare bike. And obviously it's like such a rush because you need to get on it and you need to get back into the convoy as soon as possible, because if you lose the convoy in a women's race is pretty short, it's not like the Tour de France. If you lose the convoy, then you're fucked. So yeah, and then like I just saw my spare bike go into this thorn bush, and I was like, oh my God, I'm gonna get on my spare bike and then I'm gonna have a puncture. But anyway, whatever, I got on my spare bike, it's fine, got back into the group. But then I was already swinging a bit because, you know, you've got like the adrenaline from the crash, you've got pain, you're on your spare bike, and it's never quite the same. And you know, because I'm a female cyclist and I don't have any money, I never had enough money to like buy five of the same saddles, so I've got the same saddle on my race and training and TT bike, and then actually I've got a slightly different saddle on my spare bike because I just, is one that I got off eBay because I didn't want to have to buy a new one because they're 150 quid each. So you know, it is the same. And you know, we've got Dura Race on our race bikes, and then Altegra on the spare bikes, and it's just like your spare bike just doesn't feel quite as good, and it just doesn't feel quite the same. So I said in the radio, you know, can I get my spare bike, can I get my race bike fixed? I think it's just the shifter, everything else seemed to be fine. So then on the next lap, or really really quickly, they managed to fix my race bike. So when there was another moment, which I knew wasn't going to be for a full lap, then I would be able to swap again.